Tickets are now on sale for Side by Side, Union Gallery's annual major fundraiser. Join us on Saturday, February 8th for an afternoon of live music, artsy activities, and a lottery-style draw where everyone is a winner. Take home a one-of-a-kind artwork and support Union Gallery's nonprofit mission. Come visit the exhibition or check out the online catalog to see the 100-plus works available. Head to uniongallery.ca and get your tickets for Side by Side today.
Good morning. It is 11 a.m. on Friday, February 7th, and you're tuned in to CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Lower Carruthers Hall on Queen's Campus in Kingston, Ontario. I'm CFRC's broadcast journalist, Christina Laurie, and this is Kingston Currents. CFRC's news programming is brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. In today's episode, we'll be covering a demonstration that took place outside of Kingston General Hospital earlier this week, a major update in bargaining for Queen's University workers, and the highlights from Kingston City Council meeting this week.
I will be honest, it feels bizarre, kind of in limbo. I'm not wearing my work uniform today because I fully believed we were walking out this morning. But yeah, obviously I am I'm happy that this could be resolved at the bargaining table and look forward to seeing the agreement at a ratification vote.
That was Sarah Alux, a caretaker at Queen's University who was involved in getting workers strike ready as negotiations with the university came down to the wire. After extensive discussions right up until late Sunday night, unions representing over 1,000 workers, including caretakers, library technicians, and lab technicians, have reached tentative agreements with Queen's. The university remained, quote, cautiously optimistic in their statements as they continue to update their labor news page throughout negotiations, finally announcing the tentative agreements in a statement on Monday. Workers celebrated their achievements at the bargaining table and the narrow avoidance of a strike at a rally outside of Richardson Hall on Queen's campus. The agreements still need to be ratified by all parties, and full details of the agreements will remain confidential pending their ratifications. However, the mood at the rally was one of hope and relief. Adam Kordick, who was at the bargaining table representing QP254, spoke with CFRC.
It definitely came down to the wire here. I was wondering if you could speak to the challenges and the process leading up to this.
Sure. So being my first time on the bargaining committee, there was a lot to learn, a lot to grasp. Our particular contract is a little bit complicated, but we worked through it and we were able to make some changes that were able to get some funds in the pockets of our members. And we believe we've reached a really good deal. Unfortunately, we're not able to go into details until we fully explain it to our members and get them to ratify it, hopefully this week. But I think we've made a lot of progress. I was really happy with the outcome. I think we made great strides in a lot of non-monetary areas as well, but especially with the deal that finally came across the table. It was a lot of back and forth. It was a lot of restlessness. I've been very, very anxious, but I think all that anxious energy and especially all the preparation we all did. Like, we all got this deal together. We all came together and we got this deal because we were prepared, because we were ready, because we were loud, and I think our voices have been heard, and that's the most gratifying thing.
How are you hoping this can benefit Queen's workers?
Firstly, by making sure our members are paid what they're worth, and making sure the members of all the locals here, like, we were all united on this front. I think we came together and we achieved great strides for everybody. And I hope to see this level of coordination and cooperation in the future. And I think I think overall we're going to see a little bit of relief at the end of the month, because I know for many of us that's a very stressful time when the bills are coming in and the money's just not quite there. So I think this will make a huge impact on the lives of our members, and hopefully, like, with our members being in a better state, we're going to be have more positive interactions with the students, and we're going to be able to deliver services at a greater level than we were before.
Are you hopeful that members will be able to ratify this agreement?
Yes, I'm very hopeful. I'm cautiously optimistic was a word that was thrown around a lot last night, and I'm feeling good. And I think that's the most we can ask for at this point.
Other Queens workers also had a strong presence at the rally, showing their support for their QB colleagues. Professor Karen Rudy with the Queen's University Faculty Association also spoke with CFRC at the rally.
We recognize as professors that the backbone of the university are many of the QP unions, and we wholeheartedly support them getting better wages and better working conditions.
Final ratification votes will take place in the coming days.
You were just telling me about your umbrella here.
Yes! So my umbrella, it says Stop the Hospital Cuts, was developed by QP and in conjunction with O2 8 years ago. And here I stand again in front of KGH Emerge with this umbrella and my flag, and there's been no resolution. It's been a long fight, and it continues to be a fight.
Would you say it's gotten better or worse?
It's been worse. That's why the stretchers are here, you know? So it's hallway medicine now. The cuts back then, we saw hallway medicine, but not to the degree. So it's just been eroding and eroding year after year after year. And it's disheartening. And we have to ensure in this election that that changes.
Who you just heard from was Julia Lynch, a retiree with QP at a demonstration organized by QP's Ontario Council of Hospital Unions on Monday outside of Kingston General Hospital. On the eve of the provincial election, O2 QP members and supporters set up a lineup of hospital stretchers outside of Kingston General Hospital, symbolizing, quote, the crisis in Ontario's healthcare. This demonstration is taking place at hospitals across Ontario, with Northumberland, Sudbury, Belleville, Oshawa, London, Peterborough, and more municipalities seeing similar sights this week. Michael Hurley, president of QP's Ontario Council of Hospital Unions, spoke with CFRC at the demonstration.
You had the stretchers out here in front of Kingston General
Yes.
Hospital. I was wondering if you could speak a bit to the symbolism there and why you decided to demonstrate this way.
Well, the stretchers, represent the 2,000 people who are on stretchers in hospital hallways on any given day in Ontario now. That's up from 850 when the current government promised to eliminate them. But we also want to talk about the fact that there's 250,000 people waiting for surgeries, and that over 11,000 of those people died waiting last year. We want to talk about the 2.5 million people who don't have a family doctor, and the 50,000 people who are waiting for long-term care. So those are all issues that we'd really like to see have more discussion in this election.
As you mentioned, that we do have a specific focus on overcrowding and hallway health care in today's demonstration. I was wondering if you could speak a bit about the issues that lead to that and what issues those cause.
Well, the reason that we have this problem is because we have an aging and growing population, and we spend the least of any province and consequently have the fewest hospital beds and hospital numbers of hospital staff to patients of any hospital system in the world with a developed economy. And so the way people experience that is that they are turned away, even though they might be acutely ill, or they'll spend days on a stretcher waiting for a bed, or their surgery will be delayed for, a year, for 2 years, in some tragic cases, people will miss an early diagnosis of cancer because they don't have access to the kind of primary care that they should have, the access to a family doctor. And so these are all manifestations of a system which is really struggling as a result of undercapacity.
And I was wondering if you could dive a bit deeper into the specific issue of hallway healthcare.
Well, this is a really sinister development. I mean, we've closed so many hospital beds in this province. Like in Kingston, you used to have two functioning acute care hospitals. Now you've got one. You've undergone a significant reduction in the number of beds that you have available to the public over the years. But now the population is growing. and it's aging. So as people age, they need more care. And where are they looked after? Often they're looked after on stretchers in the hallway. And that deprives people of any privacy or any dignity. And it also subjects them to risk from the close proximity of having people together like this means that the chance of them acquiring a hospital infection like MRSA or C. difficile is significantly higher. And because of the understaffing situation, the risk of medical error for these people and for all the patients in the hospital is significantly increased as well. Anything over 85% capacity, and you have the possibility of medical error going up significantly. And in Ontario, and in a hospital like this one, we operate significantly over 85% capacity.
Mm-hmm. And this is a constant issue, but why specifically today for this demonstration?
Well, in the context of the provincial election, we wanted to try to raise this issue and to popularize it, get people talking about it, and encouraging them to talk about their own experiences with healthcare, and demand of all the political parties that they put forward programs that would actually make some meaningful changes. And for example, like we would call for confirmed funding for a hospital like this one on a five-year basis with a significant infusion of new money with the goal of getting people off the stretchers and off the surgical wait lists. We'd want a commitment like that from a party running for government.
Doug Allen, a senior healthcare researcher at CUPE, provided some key insights from CUPE's research that underscore the challenges facing healthcare workers and the current state of patient care.
Ford ran on a platform of ending hallway healthcare in 2018. We're now 1,034 beds more than when he came to power. It's an over 100% increase. Funding is the lowest across Canada for hospitals of any province. Staff-wise, we're missing about 34,000 staff compared to other provinces on a per capita basis. Because the funding is so low, we're in the first half of this fiscal year, Ontario hospitals have a revenue shortfall of about $800 million. In the case of this hospital here, KHSC, we're running $12.5 million short of funding. The government doesn't make clear funding, and the hospitals just have to muddle through. Michael, I think, mentioned that we have a need for extra beds and that we're running at very high bed occupancies. For KHSC, we need another 56 beds, staffed and beds and in operation in order to run at a safe level. And because of all of these sorts of backups and they end up in the emergency room, people can't move out of those beds until they move to other areas, is that fully 82% of patients who are admitted to the hospital at KHSC through the emergency room are not admitted within the target wait time of 8 hours. So, you know, big backups, frustration.
Members of the Kingston Health Coalition were also present to show their support. Co-chair of the Kingston Health Coalition, Joan Jardin, shared what response she's hoping to see from the province.
I want the Ontario government to work with the people to do what's best for people. And that is our public health care system that we fought so hard for. In fact, we shouldn't be fighting for the very basics now. We should be looking to expand and make it better. This is Ontario, Canada. If we can't have good health care in Ontario, Canada, where in the world can we? And I do not believe in the excuse of there is no money, because we've seen where money has been spent. And I would rather the money be spent on people. It's an investment in people. It helps their life, makes it better, and in fact saves money in the long run. It's the most important thing that we can do, and we should actually build on it.
According to a message from the Ministry of Health, the provincial government has made record investments in the publicly funded healthcare system. Since 2018, the province has increased the healthcare budget by over 31%, investing over $85 billion into the system in 2024. The ministry did not respond to requests for additional comments regarding the demonstration from CFRC. Before we get into more local news, I'm going to turn to our weather and traffic report for this morning, featuring CFRC's Jesse Bell.
The This is Jesse Bell with the Environment Canada Weather Report for the Kingston region. Friday, February 7th, daytime high of -5, mix of sun and cloud, and a 30% chance of flurries. Saturday, February 8th, going to be a little bit colder with a daytime high of -5, but an overnight low of -14. Sunday, February 9th, we're going to see slightly warmer weather, daytime high of -1, overnight low of -9, with a 60% chance of snow flurries. And Monday, February 10th, we are going to see a daytime high of -3, a mix of sun and cloud during the day, and it's going to drop down to -12 overnight. This is Jesse Bell with the City of Kingston Traffic Report for the week of Monday, February 3rd, 2025. We begin with the road closures. Aberdeen Street, William DeJohnson, is closed to accommodate construction activity and staging. Princess to 486 Albert is closed to accommodate construction activity and staging at 484 Albert Street. Avenue Road, McMahon to 283 Avenue, is closed February 3rd at 7 a.m. to February 17th at 7 p.m. for a service connection replacement. Earl to Aberdeen and Division, closed February 3rd to 10th to support construction activity. Frontenac Street, Brock to Johnson, is closed February 4th and 5th from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. each day for the replacement of a service connection. King Street, Young to Sir John A. McDonald, is closed February 6th from 6 a.m. to 11 p.m. for filming at Kingston Penitentiary. If a weather event occurs February 6th, the closure will take place from February 7th from 6 a.m. to 11 p.m. Again, that's only if a weather event occurs to delay filming. Market Street, King to Ontario, closed January 27th to February 21st for the Spirit of Winter. Queen Street, Division to Clergy, closed until February 7th for the demolition of 283 Queen Street. Here are some other delays to be aware of. Front Road, Sand Bay to Country Club, expect delays for the installation of sanitary and water main for Utilities Kingston. Traffic will be reduced to one lane in each direction. Please be aware of lane shifts, traffic speed limits, and share the lane signage. Highway 2, Abbeydon to St. Lawrence, expect delays to complete enhanced flood protection of Abbeydon Road, Highway 2, and St. Lawrence Avenue.
Thank you, Jesse. Now back to more local news. The Kingston Canadian Film Festival is returning for their 25th year with more local films on the docket than ever before. KCFF 2025 will present 5 Made in Kingston films, the most ever, at the festival next month, in addition to 8 short films produced through their local shorts program. This will also mark the world premiere for many of these films. This comes as Kingston's film sector is potentially on the cusp of some major growth. Ambitious actors in Kingston's film scene have been pioneering a new era, which includes an emphasis on homegrown start-to-finish productions and possibly a brand new film studio in town for this purpose before the year is up. Festival director Mark Garness spoke with CFRC about this year's elevated local film presence. This is the most local films to be featured at KCFF. I was wondering if you could speak to that and what it says about Kingston's film industry.
Yeah, well, I think when I started, my first year at the festival was 2000, and I started in 2012. My first festival was 2013, and we didn't have any local features that year. And it was in those early days for me, it was very rare to even see a local feature. We would maybe get one like every other year type thing, but we had a local shorts program, which that's been here for 25 years, and it's always been a really strong program. Oftentimes, it's a lot of film students at Queen's creating those films. But one thing I've noticed is just more filmmakers living here year round and in the community making films. So I think like through Queen's, there's always been a strong output of short films, but now we're seeing more shorts being created by people in the community. And then also the big thing I'm noticing is more features now. So like this year we have, I think we have four locally produced features. And last year, I think we had 3. So now it seems like year in, year out, we have a few features being made by Kingstonians, which was something I didn't see in my early days.
Mm-hmm. And has it been a kind of like a slow progression to get here, did you find, or was there kind of a big boom of local filmmaking?
Yeah, I would say it was more gradual. Like I think when I started, it was just like, yeah, like I said, it was very rare to see a local feature. And then I don't know, one year we maybe had 2, and then one year we had 3. And so it's kind of been gradual. And Kingston had its got a film office, I think it was in went in 2019, so that certainly helped. And Alex was the original film officer as well, so and he's maintains a close connection to the festival to this day, and has been on the board and was the early director as well. So I know he's when he was in that role was always looking up for the festival as well. So yeah, I think now with more supports in place, like the film office, and then I think also locals knowing that there is a exhibition space for their films if they do create one, like knowing that KCFF will play them, I think is both those things have led to a higher output.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's the 25th anniversary. I was wondering if you could speak a bit to the festival's growth and how that's kind of coincided or had a relationship with our local film industry growth till now.
Yeah, like it's so every year I've been with the festival, like other than the pandemic years, which just is not really a comparable, but every like I guess non compromised festival has grown in attendance. And you know, just tying it back to the local stuff, I think anytime you can include a local film or more local talent in the lineup, it's bringing in people that may not show up otherwise. So, you know, for example, like we have an 18 millimeter program, which is youth filmmakers, and you know, they're bringing a mom and dad and brother and sister and friends and family that are there to support their kid, and they are often coming to the festival for the first time through that path. And then I think once they're there, they're like, oh, there's a lot more to this festival than I realized, and you know, maybe I'll go check out another film. So it's been, I think, including some of the local productions has been a way to provide a new point of entry into the festival for some people who've maybe known about it but have never actually taken a chance on it. So that's not why we do it, to grow the festival. We do it to support the local filmmakers, but it is a nice byproduct of including more local, is that I think our core audience does grow.
Garnis also included one of the local films in his highlights for this upcoming festival.
It's a tie between many things, but I would say Single Woman Seeking Child is one that I'm excited for, but also proud of. We had a 25th anniversary contest last year. It was a script reading contest where we had five people do live pitches in front of a jury, and Blaine Waters was the filmmaker who won. So we helped fund his new short film that's going to be playing at the festival this year. And yeah, it was all shot in Kingston. So you'll see like lots of downtown familiar landmarks, and it's a story about his family and him growing up here. And it's only 15 minutes, but he nailed it. It's amazing. It's got like the arc of like a full 90 minute feature film. I don't know if his intention is to make it into a feature or not. Like, it's pretty hot off the press. Yeah, I know he's bringing his family over to the premiere at the festival. And so, yeah, it was just nice to be involved in it, going back to last festival, and knowing that we had a hand in bringing this to life by funding it and then now premiering it at the festival. So I guess if I was forced to pick one, that would be the one I'm looking most forward to.
Once again, that was Mark Garnis, Executive Director of the Kingston Canadian Film Festival, on this year's record number of local productions being featured. The Kingston Canadian Film Festival has announced that the award-winning documentary Blue Rodeo, Lost Together will be the closing night film on Sunday, March 2nd. This screening will bring Blue Rodeo co-founder and Queen's University alumnus Jim Cuddy back to Kingston alongside co-founder Greg Keeler and director Dale Heslip. Cuddy and Keeler narrate the film, telling the story of Toronto band Blue Rodeo from their beginnings to their current status as one of Canada's most cherished bands. In anticipation of the event, we spoke with Jim Cuddy and director Dale Heslip about what festival attendees can expect. What can audiences expect from this film closing out KCFF this year?
Oh, I think it's fantastic that it's closing the Kingston Film Festival. I think it's fantastic that Jim and Greg went to Queen, so it's going to have this sort of this emotional connection, because it kind of all started there. It started on a car ride going from Kingston to Toronto, and they decided to make a band, and they've been together ever since. So we've been getting a lot of really great reaction to the film, and it played at the Whistler Film Festival in December. It played at the Salt Spring Film Festival just last week. It's playing the Hot Docs Theater Saturday night. Sold out. Jim Gregg, myself, and Erica M are going to do a Q&A. Then it's doing Cineplex across the country, like 38 theaters across the country, February 2 and 3, before it comes to Kingston. So I don't know. The ticket sales have been going crazy. There's obviously a ton of Blue Rodeo fans out there. And I don't know. We really like it. I have to say, when we heard that the band liked the doc after we sent it to them, I was like, yes, thank God. But the fans have been reacting the same way. There's a real nice honesty to this doc, and it's a really nice way to get to know the band, that's for sure.
Yeah, and Jim, how is it for you to be, you know, reflecting back?
You know what? It was a real joy to go down memory lane to do the doc, but it also uncovered some uncomfortable times. I mean, I think in a 40 years span, life together, there are going to be some difficult times, and maybe those times were a little more difficult than I remembered. And so it was good to drop my suppressed guard and just take things for the way they were, because now they're good. And so it's easier to look back on the difficult times when times are rosy. So yeah, it's amazing. I think that Greg and I started as high school friends. And so I think that for any of this to have happened to us would be unimaginable. I think we both realized at a certain time we wanted to absorb ourselves in music for the rest of our lives, but whether we were going to be able to do that or not, who knew? And so to find ourselves here, even talking about a documentary, is full of gratitude and wonder.
Cuddy also dove into his time at Queens prior to Blue Rodeo and his roots in Kingston.
Right. Well, I graduated from Queens in 78, and Greg picked me up, and I told him that I wanted to devote 1 year to music, and then I would go to law school or something. And he said, well, let's get a band. And so from that car ride till now, we've had a band. So we planned a band. We got a band called the Hi-Fis. That played for about 3 years in Toronto. Then we moved to New York, and we had a band down there where my wife, girlfriend at the time, went to acting school. And it wasn't until we came back to Toronto in 84 and got Blue Rodeo together in 85. So that had been, you know, I'd been out of school 7 years at that point. And it wasn't until that point that we got this band that we thought, wow, this is a really good band. I mean, we had Cleve and Basil, and then we had Bobby Wiseman. And I think no matter what had happened to us, we would have been happy that that band was so good and played our song so well. So, and then it goes from there, but that we had a very strong start. After 7 years of, you know, of meandering, we had a very strong start when we finally got Blue Rodeo together.
Well, how does it feel to be returning to Kingston after all these years?
Well, I love Kingston, and I probably play there once a year. Like my roots in Kingston go way back. My parents went to Queens. My dad came there. My mom was from Prince Edward County, so she obviously wanted to go to Queens and wanted to get out of Prince Edward County. And my dad came as a war vet, and they met and they married, and then they had their life, had their kids, they divorced. And then when we were young parents, when I was a young parent with my wife, my parents went back to Queens and remarried. So that's two marriages. My wife and I met at Queens, and now our youngest son, who just married his girlfriend, they met at Queens well. So we're three generations and four marriages, one couple twice.
Yeah, so it must be special to kind of, you know, be returning for this.
Absolutely, absolutely. No, I loved it. I loved it in Kingston. I loved my years in Queens, and I love going back. There's something very inspiring about it. There's something very tranquil about it, and yet there's a lot of energy on the campus, and it's not too bro for me, and it's a great place.
Once again, that was co-founder of band Blue Rodeo, Jim Cuddy, and director Dale Heslip on the documentary Blue Rodeo Lost Together, closing out KCFF this year. Before we wrap up this morning, we're going to run through your Friday forecast, a roundup of just some of the events Kingston has to offer this weekend. Tonight on February 7th, both Daft Brewing and The Buckle will be hosting karaoke nights starting at 9 p.m.
The City of Kingston's Spirit of Winter Festival continues at Springer Market Square, with festivities starting for the seventh day in a row at 6 p.m. On Saturday, February 8th, the East End Weekly Run Group meets at Chemex Kingston Supermart at 7:50 a.m. The Kingston Public Market runs at Market Square starting at 8:30 a.m. Also, a Valentine's Day pop-up market will take place at the Tet Center from 10:30 a.m. onward. On Sunday, February 9th, the Memorial Center Farmers Market is taking place starting at 9 a.m. An oil paint techniques forest scene workshop is taking place at 370 King Street, also starting at 9. And finally, the Toucan will be hosting karaoke starting at 10:30. That is all things current in Kingston for this week. Thank you for listening to CFRC's local news programming, brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. To listen on the go and hear more from some of our guests, be sure to head to our podcast network at podcast.cfrc.ca. Be sure to stay tuned for more CFRC programming coming up next.
What'll I Wear offers the best in vintage, funky, one-of-a-kind treasures, clothing, accessories, and a fabulous selection of jewels, vintage and new. Find the cutest purse, the most dashing of hats and sunglasses, everything to complete your individual look. What'll I Wear has it all. They can dress you from top to bottom. Find your new fashion fave at What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street in Kingston. Visit their new location and follow them on Facebook to keep up to date with what's in store at What'll I Wear.
Hello and welcome to this edition of Viewpoints on today's show. Cannabis impaired driving is on the rise in Winnipeg.
Some people don't feel the effects right away with the edibles.
Winnipeg, where Muslim and Indigenous communities unite to inspire systemic change.
And I think people are, in general, really committed to the collective good and really trying to figure out a way to lift each other up and to ensure the dignity and humanity of all people.
Canadian composer Eric Lankin launches his first classical music project, the Icarus album.
Despite the grief and the tragedy, it is a celebration of Icarus on both sides of the veil, from the living and the afterlife.
Seniors are meeting up in Waterloo to talk about travel at the Friday Flicks Travel Show.
People are not interested to stop and hear a lecture. They want to see the pictures. Our audience wants to not only enjoy the afternoon and meet other people, but they also want to learn something.
The cities of St. John and Moncton bid to co-host the 2029 Canada Games.
It makes for an opportunity for both communities to share the opportunity, also share the risk of hosting something like this.
Queen's County athlete Abigail Smith will join Team Canada's European Judo Tour.
It's crazy to me. I didn't think it was going to happen. It's really exciting.
And our solar system will again put up a great show during the Great Alignment.
Right now, we are at the right place at the right time. Right? Gotcha. And we won't be able to see that for over 50 years again. So this is rare.
Welcome to Viewpoints, local news nationwide.
You are on the air with Viewpoints. Listen to all our stories on frequencynews.ca.
Hello and thank you for being with us again this week. My name is Boris Chassaigne. I'll be with you for the next half hour and in good company. Our national correspondents are feeding us great stories this week. First up, out west, the Winnipeg Police, in collaboration with Manitoba Public Insurance, just launched a road watch drug-impaired driving enforcement initiative. Running from January through March, the campaign targets drivers under the influence of cannabis and other substances. Constable Peterson explains that another aspect of the campaign is to increase awareness of how cannabis, particularly edibles or ingested cannabis, affects the body. The risks associated with edibles stem from their delayed onset. They can take several hours to peak. This delay can lead to overconsumption and an overwhelming level of impairment. Details with Ryan Funk in Winnipeg, Manitoba.
You know, when it comes to cannabis impairment, we are seeing a constant rise.
Running from January through March, the campaign targets drivers under the influence of cannabis and other substances. According to the Liquor, Gaming and Cannabis Authority of Manitoba, the sale of cannabis edibles has nearly doubled since legislation in 2018.
When it comes to edibles and products in general, cannabis products, we're seeing you know, that the numbers keep rising quite significantly and very concerning to us in that sense.
The risks associated with edibles stem from their delayed onset, unlike smoked cannabis, which affects users almost immediately. Edibles can take several hours to peak. The delay can lead to overconsumption and an overwhelming level of impairment.
And what we've been seeing through some of the studies that and training that we've been receiving is some people don't feel the effects right away with the edibles. They may take some more, consume some more to feel the effects. Now, only in a few hours, it all of a sudden kicks in and it's kind of an overwhelming effect that they receive.
Constable Peterson says the Winnipeg Police Service has increased officer training to detect cannabis impairment with the use of standardized field sobriety tests and approved drug screening equipment to evaluate drivers. This equipment includes oral fluid tests, which detect recent oral drug use. Last year's enforcement project yielded 243 traffic stops, 148 oral fluid tests, 43% tested positive for cannabis, 36 Provincial Offenses Act notices, including unlawful storage of cannabis in vehicles and passenger consumption. The Winnipeg Police Service is spreading its message through social media, press releases, and public outreach. While specific educational efforts in schools were not confirmed, the broader goal is to initiate conversations at home and among young drivers that impaired driving is a year-round concern. I'm Ryan Funk.
Hey, I'm Anastasia Abakumova in beautiful British Columbia, and you are tuned to Viewpoints.
Ryan Funk, who has also produced a piece on how the Winnipeg Muslim and Indigenous communities unite to inspire systemic change. This, as the City of Winnipeg hosted its first Muslim Indigenous Solidarity Conference, with the two-day event divided into several panels and discussions on the impacts of colonization, ongoing discrimination, allyship, and reconciliation. In this excerpt, Ryan spoke with Leah Gazan, Member of Parliament for Winnipeg West, and Dr. Ingrid Mattson, London and Windsor Community Chair of Islamic Studies at Huron University College.
You know, we can't look at our oppressions in isolation. It's important right now, particularly with the rise of extremism, for people to work together to ensure human rights for all peoples. You can't pick and choose when to uphold human rights. We are in a human rights battle right now, and I have confidence in humanity that human rights will prevail at the end of the day.
But what we'll find instead is if we do put effort into understanding what is happening to other people who are being oppressed, we put a little bit of that effort and then we listen to them and stand beside them, what we find is often our exhaustion starts to lift. We start to feel energized because now we found someone who understands, who can sometimes help share our burden and we share theirs.
It's not just two communities here. I see actually a very diverse audience, and I think people are in general really committed to the collective good and really trying to figure out a way to lift each other up and to ensure the dignity and humanity of all people.
Listen to the rest on frequencynews.ca. You can also find on Frequency another story that we could not fit into this episode of Viewpoints, but it's well worth the listen. A 22-minute documentary about the Canadian classical music composer Eric Lankin, who just launched his debut work, the Icarus album, at the Waterloo North Mennonite Church, a place with deep connection to the composer's family. Lankin says he composed this album as a metaphor for losing his father to mental illness. Here's an excerpt of that 22-minute documentary from Dan Keller in Kitchener, Ontario.
I'm Eric Lankin. I grew up in Kitchener, Waterloo, lived for a time in Guelph and a time in Hamilton, and have been based in Montreal for the past 6 years now. I'm a composer of new classical music. I am a political troublemaker, and I'm someone who struggles with mental health and manages to function very highly, despite living with bipolar. So I created a new classical music album. It is called the Icarus Album. It's an instrumental album in the sense that there's no lyrics or vocals, but nevertheless, it's very narrative, and it combines performances by some of Canada's best classical soloists, certainly Montreal's best classical soloists, and it also features sound design that I made with the great Devin Bate, who is easily one of Canada's most important producers. And so the album, for me, is inspired by the myth of Icarus. Icarus is a character who I've always felt drawn to ever since my diagnosis of bipolar. He's a common metaphor for living with bipolar in the sense that you cannot fly too high, or the sun will melt your wings, and you cannot fly too low, or the water will wet your wings and you will fall into the ocean and die.
Intriguing, is it not? A beautiful music from the Icarus album by Canadian composer, now based in Montreal, Eric Lankin. In an early review of the Icarus album, critiquer Robin B. James of V-Glue magazine wrote, "This amazing work of Eric Lankin creates a new triumph, which I would place high in the pantheon of significant human musical expressions."
You're on the air with Viewpoints.
So how to transition from such beautiful music? Should we talk about traveling to foreign countries or about the solar system? Well, we'll do both. The Friday Flicks travel show program hosted by the City of Waterloo at the Community Pavilion is drawing crowds of 120, 150, and even up to 180 people at a time. They gather every other Friday afternoon to listen to a presentation about someone else's travel story. The program has been running for well over 10 years, and in the last few years has really begun to pick up steam with 2,400 attendees in 2024. Journalist Leah Gerber spoke with Sarah Kelly, who organizes the program for the City of Waterloo, as well as longtime participant, volunteer host, and presenter Rick Chambers about the program and what exactly is drawing all these people together.
We often stop for at least half a day in San Jose, the capital, and it's not a remarkable city, really, but it does have a couple of features that are worthwhile seeing.
Janice Bach is wearing a microphone headset and slowly strolling through a seated crowd of about 150 people on a Friday afternoon in Waterloo. The room is packed. Bach is a featured speaker for one of the City of Waterloo's programs called the Friday Flicks Travel Show. It's all about people coming together to listen to others' travel stories. Sarah Kelly is a programmer in youth, adult, and older adult programming at the City of Waterloo who organizes the program.
For 2024, some of the shows were Dubai, exploring the desert and the UAE. A few of them were on the Canary Islands. We had a show on Denmark and Copenhagen. We had one on Portugal. We had someone that was celebrating their 40th wedding anniversary, and they went on a European river cruise. So then we got to hear all about the castles and cathedrals and medieval villages from Amsterdam to Budapest. We had shows on Italy and South Africa. We usually have at least about 80 to 90 people that pre-register. We are almost at, like, when we're up to 180, we're almost at max capacity. So we're almost at the point where we have to turn people away.
In the last few years, Friday Flicks has become massively popular. In 2021 and 2022, the program attracted 875 attendees each year. 2023 saw 1,300 attendees, while 2024 saw 2,400, and there's no sign of it slowing down. Kelly says, on average, each show attracts about 120 to 150 participants. The highest she's seen is 180 for one show, and that was about a bird-watching trip to South Africa. The group meets every other Friday from 1:30 to 3 p.m. at the Waterloo Memorial Recreation Complex Community Pavilion. Rick Chambers is a volunteer host and presenter for the program. He's been attending for about 13 years.
Since I started in 2012, I've made over 50 presentations. What makes a good presentation is keeping the pictures going, people are not interested to stop and hear a lecture. Like they want to see the pictures, they want to hear your stories, and you know, and humor doesn't hurt as well, to throw in some things and help them see what you learned from this, because people, our audience wants to not only enjoy the afternoon and meet other people and it's a social outing, but they also want to learn something when they're there. So it's an intellectual and educational pursuit as well as a social gathering and entertainment.
The program started as a group of people getting together to watch nature and National Geographic-style documentaries and movies over 10 years ago. Then it morphed into attendees sharing their own traveling experiences. Now, a featured presenter will share a prepared presentation, which is followed by socializing time with treats and coffee.
I'm on the City of Waterloo Age-Friendly Committee, and I'm also on the region's Age-Friendly Network. And, you know, one of our great concerns is social isolation for older adults. Get them out, get them doing things, and get them socially engaged and intellectually engaged. And I think that's one of the things that the Friday Flix Travelogue does.
I'm Leah Gerber.
This is Erica Butler in Sackville, New Brunswick. You're tuned to Viewpoints.
And during the next few weeks of February, we will again be able to turn to the sky and observe its magnificence and wonder. Some of us got to watch a solar eclipse in 2024, and 2025 will provide us with another celestial show. The Great Planetary Alignment hits our screens. It's a rare celestial sight visible in our night sky, and the next one will show up only in 2040. Malar Kendekar, the president of the Prince George Astronomical Society, has spent a few orbits viewing the cosmos through the lens of the Prince George Observatory. Kendall Carr says the phenomenon should remain visible until about mid-February. Kendall Carr recommends looking at the southwest and viewing the planets through a pair of binoculars if we can, as they greatly amplify, of course, our ability to see Uranus and Neptune. Here's Ian Gregg in Prince George, British Columbia.
The Great Planetary Alignment is when all the seven planets are visible in our night sky. So all the planets actually orbit in a path in our solar system in a three-dimensional way called an ecliptic, right? So every single planet orbits in an ecliptic path. So most of the time, you won't be able to see all seven planets in the evening sky at the same time. So this is a rare event. So, of course, as we know, celestial mechanics of every single planet is their orbital period of each planet is different. For example, Jupiter's orbital period is about 27 years or so. My numbers could be off. But the first planet, which is in our solar system, is the Mercury, which has the shortest orbit because it's so close to the sun, and Mercury is also tidally locked to the sun. So that planet takes about 88 days to complete one orbit. So you will see Mercury just after the sunset, just at the twilight. And then you'll see Venus, which is the brightest planet in our sky right now. It's, I think, the absolute magnitude is -4.6 or so, right? which is really bright. So in astronomy, okay, Everything is really weird. The negative meaning the objects are really bright. Positive means the object are really faint.
Interesting. So one aspect of the significance is that seven of these planets are visible in our night sky. And the other aspect is that they are in alignment. You actually can look up and see them in a...
That's right. So when you think about an alignment, we think as a straight line in one dimension, right? But we're looking at the solar system, so the sun and the moon, they're in two-dimensional order.
That's how we perceive them from our point on Earth.
That's right. For an observer, it's two-dimensional. And then when we're looking at other planets, it gets into three-dimensional. So the planets are always aligned in our solar system because they're following the same orbital path, which is on the ecliptic. But the difference about this one is they will be visible because their orbit right now, it's in such a way that they will be actually visible in our night sky, all the seven planets, including Mercury, Venus, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, Neptune, and Uranus. All those seven planets will be visible. So right now we are at the, you know, we can say right place at the right time, basically. Right. Gotcha. And we won't be able to see that for over 50 years again. So this is rare.
So make sure you take a look up at the sky starting January 24th through to...
So right now, just after the sunset, you will be able to see at least four or five planets. 25th January is just the date that someone decided that's going to be the best view.
Okay.
But is it really true? No, unfortunately.
Okay.
Right? So they have been kind of visible for almost 10 to 15 days, and the visibility will actually get better as Mercury will be kind of above the horizon and not really, you know, very close to the horizon. It will be about 20, 25 degrees above the horizon. So at that time, you will be able to actually see all the seven planets. You will get a good view of that.
Okay.
So you will see it at least until the end of February, all the seven planets. So you do have a lot of window of opportunity to actually see all those seven planets. One thing you have to be mindful of, you won't be able to see Uranus and Neptune with your naked eye, because those two planets are quite far away. And, I mean, if you do have a good eyesight, you will be able to see Neptune and Uranus. I have a terrible eyesight, so I can't see them. But, yeah, even if you have a small pair of binoculars, there are lots of applications for Android or iPhones like SkyView, SkyMap, StarMap. So you can actually point your phone in the night sky and get the exact location for all the planets.
You can kind of ID where in the sky you should be looking and then bring your binoculars up to that point, and there's a pretty good chance you're going to see something.
That's right, for Uranus and Neptune. And for other five planets, they're extremely bright, so it's really easy to see those planets like Jupiter, Venus, Saturn. Mars will be really red. So another thing to notice about the planets when you're looking for the planets in the night sky is the planets won't blink like other stars do because of the atmospheric turbulence. So even in the low atmosphere, even there is a high air mass, the planets won't blink because we are looking inside our solar system, and they are much more brighter as compared to the stars because they are, you know, thousands of light years away.
Simply further away.
That's right. So that's a great way to look for the great planetary alignment.
Right.
Yeah.
In your time volunteering and working with the observatory, do you have a favorite celestial event that you've witnessed? And do you think that this event might actually eclipse that?
There are so many, honestly. And over the years, I have seen or discovered gamma ray burst, supernovae, tidal disruption event, meaning a star getting sucked by a supermassive black hole.
Wow.
It was all CCD, like taking images systematically of the entire night sky, and then we look for these transient events, right? That's one of the research that I do. But from the observatory, one of the cool things I've seen is a comet, which I think was in 2020, C2020F4, also called as Neowise, that was visible to the naked eye. And then just last year in November, we had another comet called Comet Atlas, C2024Q4, that was also visible to the naked eye. So periodically, you will get all these really cool comets that you can actually take photos of, or sometimes even the comets will be visible to the naked eye as well. But this event is a rare event because we might not be able to see it again in our lifetime. So looking forward to seeing some of the planets that are visible.
Excellent. Visiting us from the Prince George Astronomical Society, Mr. Malhar Kendekar. Your time and expertise are very much valued.
Thank you.
Thanks for cluing us into this celestial event.
Hello, I'm Candace Vetter in Embrun, Ontario, and you're tuned into Viewpoints.
The cities of St. John and Moncton are hoping to host the 2029 Canada Games and submitted their bid to the Canada Games Council. If the bid is successful, 2029 will be the first time St. John has hosted these games since 1985. Journalist Yono Ko spoke with the bid committee's co-chair based in St. John, Bill McMacken, and with Andrew Beckett of Envision St. John, the growth agency responsible for economic development, about the process and the interaction between the two cities, as well as about what the games will ultimately look like.
It's essentially New Brunswick turn to host the Canada Summer Games. Last January, the province kicked off the bidding process. We are doing a comprehensive bid document. We will hear about that in February, and they'll do a site visit. And we should know in early April that it's official. We've had really positive feedback from our community partners, from our municipalities in both regions. There's strong support in the St. John region and the Moncton region for this, so we think we're in good shape. It makes for an opportunity for both communities to share the opportunity, also share the risk of hosting something like this, and it allows us to take advantage of the best assets between the two regions and pull together a really regional approach in Greater Moncton and the St. John region, which is going to, I think, result in a really positive event for the community.
Our feeling in terms of doing it collaboratively was that there's ways to better utilize existing assets in both areas to minimize the amount of capital investment that's going to be required and deliver a product that was going to be really good for the athletes that are coming, beneficial to the entire province. I think there's great opportunities for us to be doing more in collaboration with whether it's Moncton or Fredericton on other things, but we just, rather than being in a win-lose situation, we think there's an opportunity for both communities to do very well through these types of collaborations. The operating budget for the games is in the $35 to $40 million range. A good portion of that, about $10, $11 million, is paid for by the federal government. The province will be putting in $7 or $8 million towards it. Local municipalities have agreed to contribute $4 million, and then there's a whole fundraising part that goes along with it. But so it's a fairly big undertaking. These are great community-building events. People still talk about the 1985 Canada Games when it was here, and it's a great way to build community. Events like the Canada Games provide a really interesting space to bring people together in a joint celebration.
These interviews were conducted by Yona Ko in St. John, New Brunswick.
Questions or comments? Our email is radio@frequencynews.ca. radio@frequencynews.ca.
I do not know if the 11th grade student Abigail Smith will take part in the 2029 Canada Games, but I can tell you, though, that the Liverpool Regional High School student will be competing against judokas from other countries yet again as she prepares for a tour of Europe with Team Canada in March. Smith will be traveling to Spain, Portugal, and Croatia for European tournaments and training camps. The 17-year-old Brooklyn Queens co-resident, who began judo lessons when she was 4 years old, is ranked in the top 10 in her age division in Canada. Smith will have to juggle travel, training, and tournaments with school and social life. Rick Conrad in Liverpool, Nova Scotia, reached out to Abigail Smith.
So I've traveled with Team Canada one time last year, which was for an event in Germany, and like I was so excited for. And now I'm going to, I got selected to be on a tour, which is an even bigger deal. And I didn't think that would happen for me this year at all. Like my main focus was, oh, I need to win nationals, but like now I'm going to three different countries in Europe for spending a month away in Europe. Like that's, it's crazy to me. I didn't think it was going to happen this year. It's really exciting.
She said she's looking forward to the more intense competition of the European tournaments.
The training is really, like, for me, it's like the most important thing, getting to train with different bodies. Like being in Canada, you know everyone that you're training with and you're not getting familiar with different fighting styles, but getting to go outside of Canada and train with these, have these camps, like fighting round after round with people from all different countries all over the world. It's the experience, you're getting so much experience from it, which is going to make my judo like way better, and I'll see big differences. Tournaments in Europe are a lot different than tournaments in Canada. There's a lot more aggression. There's a lot more people who want to win. So I'm getting so much experience because judo is my life. Like the thing I love the most is judo and everything that comes along with it. So like for me, doing all those things, like sacrificing time with my friends, like I want to go to the Olympics. I want to be world champion. I want all these things. And I know that the goals I want and that I've dedicated so much time to, they're not going to come true unless I keep with it. So I keep with it. And my friends, everyone in my life is so supportive. They're like, no, like, go train. We'll make time later. Like, they're always, they know I need to train. My family, my friends, the community, everyone's so on board with everything I do. It makes it 10 times easier.
That was Abigail Smith speaking with Rick Conrad in Liverpool, Nova Scotia. We'll be right back. is how we close our show this week. Thanks to our many journalists, Ryan Funk, Dan Keller, Leah Gerber, Ian Gregg, Yona Koh, and Rick Conrad. And to our national editors, Conrad Funk,